Hi, everyone. This is Dawn Clem, and you are on my podcast, Milkweed and Monarchs. If you have been listening to my podcast, you heard the introduction on how I became a brain tumor nurse navigator. And I am going to be talking about various patients that I cared for throughout my 5.5 years as a brain tumor navigator. But there were three patients in particular that I am using as benchmarks for my podcast. And the reason why they're benchmarks really is because I knew them the longest. So I worked with each one of them approximately 4 years, which is a long time for a patient to have a terminal brain cancer. Each one of them impacted me differently, and it isn't like I didn't love so many of my patients, because I really did. There were so many of them that made a profound impact on me and how I look at the world, changed my lens, I would say. But these three are like milestones for me. So today I'm going to be talking about the first patient that I met. I met Chris on his first post-operative appointment to the office. This is how I usually met my patients, but there were times when the surgeons would actually ask me to go see the patients inpatient. So I did see them inpatient as well, but typically they would come to the office for their first post-operative appointment. They come into the emergency room, 99% of them, and it's usually from some kind of traumatic event that they have suffered from the brain tumor growing in their brain. So they don't know it's there. You don't have pain with it. But a brain tumor, depending on where it's located in the brain, it might cause you to have a seizure. It might cause you to pass out. It might cause you to get into a car accident. So there's various ways that they end up in the emergency room, not thinking it's because they have a brain tumor, but just that something went on and they need to have it explored. So they'll get into the emergency room, and while they're in the emergency room, neurosurgery is always called, and one of the first things that they do is get an MRI of the brain. And from that result, the neurosurgeon figures out that if they have a brain tumor and if they need surgery. Many times they end up discovering, yes, indeed, it is a brain tumor. Now, you can't necessarily tell. I guess some of the neurosurgeons could kind of get an idea, but definitively not diagnosed until you have the pathology back, that it's going to be a terminal brain tumor or grade 4 brain tumor. A grade 4 glioblastoma is a terminal illness that you are not going to survive. The other three, it's grades 1 through 4, so 1 through 3, they might also be terminal, but many times they're not terminal. You have more longevity with a lesser grade brain tumor, and some patients might live 15 years. Some patients can outlive this. So you just continue to monitor the tumor. So I'm going in to meet Chris, first post-op day in the clinic, or his first post-op appointment. While they're in the hospital, by the way, the neurosurgeon does tell them after they've done surgery what their prognosis is and what kind of tumor it is. So they already know that before they're discharged. But you can imagine that that does not mean anything really. They're in a fog. They've had anesthesia. They're not functioning. They've had brain tumor surgery. I mean, some of them are have clarity, but a lot of them really, you know, are in a fog, I would say. So that's why they come into the office 1 week postoperatively, so that we can make sure they definitely understand their diagnosis, and then we go over what the treatment plan is going to be for them. So going back to Chris, I walk into the room. Chris was a 34-year-old man. When I went into the room to introduce myself, he was there with a woman. She explained to me that he was a resident of a group home and he didn't really have any family. She was the cook at the resident home and he helped her with prep. So he would like get the salads ready or anything else that she might need to go along with the main meal. And and he loved that job, believe me. So I go in and introduce myself, and then they tell me who they are. And the very first thing he said to me is, how could this have happened to me? And then I was like, oh boy. 34 years old, already living in a group home, he's going to have a history. And sure enough, he did. He told me that his dad had died when he was young, and his mother had three sons. The two older brothers to Chris had bullied him most of his life. So he did not have a good relationship with his older brothers. He had a great relationship with his mother. Subsequently, his mother ended up having breast cancer and ultimately died from breast cancer. He said he was a teenager at that time, right around 17. His brothers were not going to take care of him in any way, and he knew it. So he became kind of a grifter, and he ended up moving to Florida. And when he got to Florida, I think he went south because he thought, if I'm going to be homeless, at least I'll be in warm weather. He ended up becoming a drinker while he was down there. And I think he was down there, you know, probably 10 years. And he ended up getting himself into a lot of trouble. I don't know the specifics about it, but I think life for him was pretty tough at that point. He decided that he was going to come back to Michigan. He knew people at least back here. Whether he got back with his brothers or not, that didn't matter to him. He felt like he could at least make his way in Michigan because he was from here. The woman that was with him said what ultimately happened is the police found him living under a Passover bridge for the freeway. So he was living under the bridge and he was passed out from drinking. And so they picked him up and they brought him to this group home. And this is what ultimately saved his life. When they came to the appointment, he had been living there for at least a couple years and was doing quite well. He got paid to be a prep cook for her. And so he was making some money. He had free room and board. They had gotten him on Medicaid, so his insurance was paying for everything that he might need. And he felt like he had a good life. He was familiar there. People knew him. He had a group that he hung out with, and things were good. So he came into the meeting knowing that he had been diagnosed with a terminal brain tumor. And I'll just never forget that moment, because after I introduced myself to him, he looked me directly in the eye and he said, "How could this have happened to me?" He said, "My mother died from breast cancer and she died because she took chemotherapy." So I don't know if she had died from the side effects from chemotherapy. Chemotherapy can be nasty. I think in recent years we've made improvements to chemotherapy, but I certainly can't dispute that some of the side effects are overwhelming for patients, especially when they're compromised to begin with. So he definitely was completely against chemotherapy right out of the gate. And I had to spend a lot of time telling him, "Your mom probably had intravenous chemotherapy." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "But you're not going to have intravenous chemotherapy. The chemotherapy that you have is a pill." And then I launched into what the entire treatment plan looked like and how he would be monitored, how he'd go through radiation. And while he was in radiation, he'd be taking chemotherapy. He'd have a month off before he actually started to let his brain heal from the surgery. Well, there were challenges right out of the gate. First of all, he had no ride to get there, and the woman was not going to be able to drive him every single day. So I had to look into getting him a bus pass. And it all sounds like it's so easy, but it's really not. I finally got him a pass on the GO bus so that he could come anytime. So that was good, and it lasted for about a month. He decided that he could get on board with treatment after I had gone over it so many times with him. He decided that he could get on board and it wasn't going to be so bad coming to clinic. So he got through his first month and then he started treatment and he came on the GO bus. And I would meet him over at the radiation building and make sure I checked in with him every day. I went every day for him. Most patients, I would only go once a week just to check in. But he had so many challenges, emotionally, mentally, and physically. From the surgery itself, he ended up having a limp. I don't know if that got exacerbated from the surgery or if he already was debilitated, but he did walk with a cane. So I wanted to make sure I had my eyes on him. And I had to go through the process of getting his chemotherapy too. So I wanted to make sure that I got the chemotherapy and all the medications for him and that he was getting everything that he needed for his treatment. It was going pretty well. He was young. He was only like 32 years old when I first met him. So he was young. And I thought, well, maybe it's like everything else, the younger patients do a little bit better. He flew through his initial 6 weeks treatment, and then he was going to have a month off, and then he would start regular chemotherapy, the pills, but it's like a schedule where you would have 1 week of chemotherapy and 3 weeks off. So he managed to get through all of that. He was getting his medications like he needed to. But the thing that he struggled with so much, more than anything else, is that he wanted to meet other people who had a brain tumor. He wanted to be able to talk to other people about what they were experiencing. I had other patients like him that wanted to talk, but there was nothing I could do about it. And it really is so unfortunate. In healthcare now, we have HIPAA laws, which is the practice of privacy. So even if I went to my director and asked her, is there any way I could just do like an email list and maybe just first names and people could sign up if they wanted to have the email chain so that they could talk amongst each other. And she was like, no way, that's a violation. Doesn't matter. It sets us up for problems later on. And I suppose it really could, because if one patient was questioning why the other patient was going through treatment, you can see that there'd be a lot of problems maybe with that. But I was thinking of it more as an emotional support thing for him. And that's really what he was looking for too. But if you start delving into other challenges, like the medication, side effects, things like that, who knows what road that would lead down, and would that be a problem? So for medical reasons and privacy laws, we weren't allowed to do that. It really bothered him, though. He was really, really upset about it. So he's moving on, doing great in clinic. His MRIs are looking good. And in the meantime, the brain tumor clinic decided that they wanted to get the word out about our brain tumor program. And the PA who I had been working with had come from another hospital where she had actually set up a 5K run to raise money and to get awareness out about a different disease that she was working with previously to coming to the brain tumor clinic. So we kind of leaned on her, and she thought she could do it. She did a heck of a job. And we picked a date. We got t-shirts. We called it the 5K for Gray Run, which was phenomenal. I think everybody was just so excited that we were going to finally get some publicity out about our program. You know, brain tumors isn't something that you hear about frequently. You'll hear about prostate cancer. You'll hear about breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer. But you don't hear about brain tumors as often. And the incidence is less, it's true, but I also think it's just the magnitude of it being a terminal illness right out of the gate. Of course, we all know about John McCain, and also Ted Kennedy died of a terminal brain tumor. So when we have that kind of publicity, it's usually in relation to somebody famous. But it doesn't really throw money our way. And we were looking for a way to get awareness out about brain tumors and also to raise funds to be able to, you know, help patients with other things while they're actively going through treatment. For Chris, he was already on welfare or Medicaid, and he didn't have a lot living in the group home. So anytime you can access some extra funds, you can help out with maybe clothing purchases or things like that, that he, being young, would appreciate. He also talked to me all the time about getting an iPhone, which I couldn't help him with that. I think ultimately he did end up getting one, and that was from his case manager. So they have case managers in the group homes that can look into things like that for him too. So the big problem for him was that he didn't have any contact. So when I told him about the 5K for Gray, meaning he didn't have contact with other patients that he could talk about. Sorry, I just want to clarify that. When I told him about the 5K for Gray, he was over the moon. He was so excited. He definitely wanted to go, and he wanted to really be amongst people who were going through the same kind of thing he was going through. And he was really, really excited about it. And he's like, well, how am I going to get there? I said, I'll come to the group home and pick you up. You will? Yes, I will come and get you. And when we're done with the 5K for Gray, when we've completed it, then we will go back to the group home and I will buy you lunch and you can take it back to the group home. So he was very excited about it. It was a goal for him to do this 5K for Gray, but it was also a means for him to see how many other people in our community had terminal brain tumors. So the day came and we had it all planned out. Believe me, every time I saw him in the clinic, that's what he was talking about. It took us about 2 months to get it organized, get publicity on it. The hospital advertised it. And so we were excited to, you know, get the ball rolling here. The day came, it's pouring rain. Isn't that always the way? And it was cold too. We had it in May and it was freezing cold and pouring rain. But I'm like, I'm going. I do not care. And I was not alone. The PA was there. The neuro-oncologist was there. The neurosurgeon was there. The neurosurgeon ran the 5K, which was incredible. And he brought his two teenage daughters and they ran the 5K. There were probably about 100 people there. So it was patients and their families. We consider that a very good turnout on such a rotten day and the first 5K that we had ever done for our program. We were so excited about it. So the PA got up, gave a little talk because she was the one that had organized the whole thing, and gave us a blessing, and everybody started. A lot of the patients just walked the 5K, and that's what Chris and I had decided to do. We were going to walk together. He needed tennis shoes, so I bought him tennis shoes and brought them to him on the day of the 5K. He was excited to get the new tennis shoes, but not half as much as he was in looking around and seeing all the people that were there. I think he, you know, he had had a tough upbringing, and I believe that he felt like he wasn't included in anything. And something about this 5K made him feel like he was a part of something. There's something wonderful about that. And there's also something so sad about that. Sad that a brain tumor would make you feel like you fit in to society. I mean, I've thought about this story so many times, believe me. So we started off, he had his cane, and I just took my time with him. I took my time. It did let up on the rain. But the sun never did come out. It was just a gray day, gray for gray matter, I guess. And we walked the whole 5K for Gray together. When he crossed the finish line, he held his cane up in the air. And somebody from the hospital media department took a picture of him. It was like the biggest victory sign that you could have ever imagined if you could have seen this young man with a brain tumor holding the cane up like, look at me, I did it, I finished. It was amazing, I'm telling you. So when we got done, a lot of the patients had converged under the podium there, and because the race was in a park. And there were picnic tables under the podium, and a lot of people were sitting there talking. So I brought Chris over to one of the picnic tables. I introduced him. Everybody was talking. Most of the patients were talking to me and their families because I knew all of them. I'm the one that was taking care of them. And I put so much time and effort into them. So I was like everybody's family member there, including Chris's. So he sat on top of the picnic table right next to where I was sitting. I was sitting on the bench of the picnic table, and he listened to everybody talk. And he had the biggest smile on his face. He heard everybody talk about how their treatment was going, how their family was involved with them or not involved with them, when they started treatment, how far along they were in treatment. There was another young guy there that was right around his age, so he paid close attention to what he was saying. We probably sat there for 40 minutes. The VP of the neurology and orthopedics department came over and she sat down and listened. I think she was just amazed at how freely the patients and their family members were talking to me. And I think she had a better appreciation and understanding maybe of what a navigator does at that point. It's so many things besides just following a patient through treatment, as you can kind of hear from the story. So then we were there for 45 minutes and everybody decided it's time to head home. And he got in the car with me. And as promised, I said, okay, I'm going to buy your lunch now. What would you like for lunch today as a celebratory lunch? And he says, I would like Kentucky Fried Chicken. And I started laughing. I mean, I would have taken him anywhere, right? I guess I should be happy it wasn't McDonald's, right? But it was Kentucky Fried Chicken. I didn't really understand at the moment why he would want Kentucky Fried Chicken. But nonetheless, I drove him to the closest Kentucky Fried Chicken there. And we got to the window. It was early. It was 11 o'clock. They had just barely opened up. And the woman said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, we're going to get a bucket of chicken. And I said, she said, well, what kind of pieces would you like? And would you like white meat or dark meat? And he said, I'll take 12 drumsticks. And she's like, what? And he says, yeah, I want to have 12 drumsticks. So she says, hold on, I got to ask if we even have 12 drumsticks or if this is an okay thing to do. So she went back and talked to the manager, and the manager says, fine. She came back and she says, okay, you can have the 12 drumsticks, but just to let you know, it probably won't ever happen again. But today, we're going to give you the 12 drumsticks. He got his sides. He didn't want anything but two large containers of mashed potatoes and gravy to go along with the drumsticks. So they put the biscuits in there too, and the butter and the honey and all that. He got a drink, and I drove him back to the group home. And when we got to the group home, he said to me, I've got this. What do you mean? I said. He said, I'm going to take the bucket of chicken in and I'm going to share it with all my friends in the group home and tell them about the experience I had today with the 5K for Gray. You don't need to come in. I'm good to go. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was amazing. I was so happy, 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 happy that he had finally gotten to do the one thing he wanted to do, connect with other people. So I helped him out of the car and I helped him over to the door of the group home. I handed him the bucket of chicken. He walked in the door. He turned around. He gave me a big smile and a thumbs up, and that was the end of the 5K for Gray day for Chris. That day impacted me too, in a big way. Something so small made such a big difference. It really made me understand the interconnectedness that we need as humans, right? We don't need to be silent. We need each other for so many things. So I understood that part. But I also understood that giving someone a goal to reach and then helping them reach that goal is so rewarding. And that was really big for him too, because he set out to do something and he finished the walk. And he was so proud of himself. And he was going to celebrate with his buddies at the group home. He lived for 4 years. I think he was 37 when his time was up. But he lived with the memory of that walk. That was such a big thing for him. And I followed him up until the very end, and he was still talking about the memory of the brain tumor walk, the 5K for Gray. Thank you for listening to my story today. I hope you enjoyed it. This is patient number one that made such a big impact on me, and I think you can understand why. Please continue to listen to my podcast. I appreciate all your comments and your support. Until the next time.